Hello, I'm Laura Greaves, and I am a card-carrying crazy dog lady, and I'm looking forward to chatting about them today.
Well, they are supposedly man's best friend, and I presume that includes women as well, and children.
Absolutely. Dogs are friends to all, and that's what's so wonderful about them.
I've come across one of your books, and it's called Dogs with Jobs, and we're going to be discussing that book today. But in doing a little bit of research about your background, I've discovered you've written some amazing books. Not only Dogs with Jobs, but Extraordinary Old Dogs, Miracle Mutts, Amazing Dogs with Amazing Jobs, The Rescuers, Incredible Dog Journeys, also a couple of novels. Have you always been crazy about dogs? What got you started?
I have always been crazy about dogs, and I'm very fortunate to have always had dogs in my life. My parents had a pair of West Highland White Terriers when I was born, and they were still around up until I was about five, I think. Their names were Ernie and Scylla, and by all accounts, they were my little protectors. They kind of appointed themselves my private security detail the moment I arrived, and got all these lovely family photos and family videos of them kind of stationed next to me like sentries. And anytime somebody approached me, they would put themselves between me and that person as if to kind of check them out and make sure that they were safe to approach. So probably on some level in my, you know, my very, very formative years, I kind of understood that bond with dogs, I think, and that unconditional love and that sense of protection that they will have towards their humans. So I was very lucky in that respect. But it was actually a dog that set me on this path, I think, to becoming an author, specifically an author who writes about dogs. So when I was 10, I got my very own dog for Christmas. He was also a West Highland White Terrier, and his name was Robbie, and I adored him. He was such a quirky little thing. He had all these strange little personality traits and idiosyncrasies that just made him, you know, him. But it's a bit of a sad story because Robbie was only 18 months old when he was hit by a car and died. And what actually happened was that the person who hit him just left him in the street. They didn't stop. They didn't try to, you know, render any kind of assistance. They just left him there to die, which very sadly he did. And I was devastated, of course. I mean, he was my little best mate and I was only 10, and it was just heartbreaking. But underneath the sadness was this incredible anger. I was just absolutely furious that anybody could be so callous as to hit a little dog and just keep on driving, just leave him there. And so I'd always been interested in writing. I'd always been kind of scribbling little poems and stories really from the very earliest age, you know, as soon as I could form letters, really. So I channeled my 10-year-old rage into a letter to the Advertiser, just expressing how angry I was and how I just couldn't fathom this cruelty of leaving this dog to die. And that letter was published, but not only was it published, the editor actually rang me to say how sorry she was about Robbie and how much she had enjoyed reading my letter. And it was really the first moment in my life that I understood the power of words and the fact that something I could write could touch somebody and could have an impact and could maybe influence or affect the way somebody thinks about things. So I'm not even sure I realized that on a conscious level, but it's certainly something that I filed away in my brain. So I actually went on to become a journalist. I worked for the Advertiser for about 5 years. I worked overseas, and then I relocated to Sydney and worked here for a number of years. And then I started writing books. And I truly, truly believe that I wouldn't have this career that I have now as an author had I not had that terribly sad, but also terribly, or incredibly, I should say, illuminating experience with my childhood dog. And I still think about him to this day, and I'm still grateful, as awful as it sounds, for that lesson. I mean, obviously, I would have preferred to have Robbie until he was 15 or 16 years old, but I definitely learned from that experience in more ways than one.
Mm. And it was also that empathy from the editor for contacting you and commenting.
Absolutely. I mean, I was 10 and she was a grown-up, you know. The fact that I had managed to move a grown-up with my words really struck me. And I remember thinking, wow, this is an adult. And I can't believe an adult is reaching out to tell me because, you know, when you're 10, you fully expect adults to take no notice of what you say. But she has, and that was very gratifying in a way. I mean, that's probably not quite the right word, but it definitely registered with me that I had had an effect on her. Yeah.
Mm. And her response to your story was nothing short of an act of kindness.
That's right. She understood. I'm not sure if she was an animal lover herself, but she understood what I had gone through, and she seemed to understand how important it is to reach out. You know, when someone loses an animal, I think if you're not an animal person, it's very hard to empathize, and you can kind of think, oh, it's just a dog, or, you know, get over it kind of thing. But of course, anyone who loves animals and anyone who's ever lost an animal knows that the grief can just be incredible. I mean, there's been studies that show that grief can persist for a year or more. And I mean, you know, in my case, it's fair to say the grief about Robbie and the way he died still persists to some level. And that's why I feel this compulsion and this need to tell stories about animals that have changed people's lives.
Well, we'll go into that further in just a minute, but you have dogs at the moment?
Yes, I have 3 dogs. In fact, last night I made a mad dash to the vet at 10 o'clock last night because one of my dogs went out for her bedtime wee and came inside with a huge gash across her head.
No, how did that happen?
I don't know what she did, but I think she walked into a tree branch or something, but oh, it was very scary, but thankfully it was superficial, so it should heal by itself. But it was just another one of those moments where I think, oh my goodness, these dogs, lucky you're cute.
All of your dogs are pedigree?
No, so 2 of them, Tex and Delilah, are Nova Scotia duck tolling retrievers, which often people have never heard of, but a lot of Adelaide people seem to be aware of them because one of the Crows has one. I forget which one. My mum would know. Anyway, one of the Crows players has a toller, and he's often in the paper, I think. So some South Australians may be familiar with them. And then my other dog, in fact, the one that necessitated the visit to the vet last night, Coco, she's a Kelpie, we think, and some other stuff. She was a rescue dog. She was actually a stray, so we don't know anything really about her background or her makeup or what she's been through or what story she could tell, but she's a very sweet girl.
Now, dogs have figured very prominently in the development of Australia. They've always been on our farms, and you see those iconic pictures of dog kennels on farms and the dogs tied up. Are we a dog-friendly nation?
That's a great question. We're definitely a dog-loving nation. I think the statistic is there's something like 3.5 million pet dogs in Australia, and that potentially doesn't even include the working dogs that you mentioned. Whether we're dog-friendly, I think we could certainly stand to be friendlier. There are a lot of places that we can't take our dogs. I mean, I live in New South Wales now, and there are very, very few dog-friendly beaches, even though we just have hundreds and hundreds of kilometres of coastline. South Australia is much better at that, operating the sort of timeshare arrangement that it does for dogs on beaches. Here in New South Wales, there's no timeshare arrangements on any of Sydney's metropolitan beaches. There are in some of the regional areas. So I definitely think we could stand to give our dogs more access to our public spaces, our beaches and our parks. And, you know, I think the UK and Europe and even North America does it better in terms of allowing dogs to really be part of everyday life. Like, I remember the first time I went to Europe, I was in a shopping centre in Amsterdam, and I bent down to the bottom shelf in a bookshop to look at something, and then the next thing I knew, there was a small dog next to me. So, I mean, in Europe, you're even allowed to take your dogs into shopping centres, and, you know, I just think that's great because I think the majority of people are probably responsible dog owners and wouldn't seek to take their dogs into these places if they didn't know they couldn't, you know, rely on good behaviour. So I certainly would like to see more of that. And I think a lot of people aren't very familiar with the rules and regulations surrounding dogs. In fact, just this week here in the Blue Mountains where I live, there was a story in our local paper about a little boy from Canberra who's on the autism spectrum and has an assistance dog. And he and his mum were trying to have a holiday here in the mountains. They're from Canberra. But they tried 2 different hotels, and neither of them would accept the booking because of the dog, which is actually illegal. You can't refuse access to a certified assistance dog in this country. And when questioned by the newspaper, the proprietors of both of those hotels said they had no idea that that was illegal.
Goodness.
And I just thought, you're in the hospitality business, you know, you need to educate yourself about these things. So, yeah, I do think for all our love of animals and the number of dogs we have, it would be lovely if we could make some more efforts to actually include dogs more as part of everyday life.
How do we go about educating the public more along those lines?
Well, that's the tricky thing. I mean, I certainly think there needs to be better public education campaigns. A lot of the animal welfare organisations do wonderful work in terms of encouraging people to dissect their dogs, to register them, to do those fundamental things of responsible dog ownership. But there's so much more to being a responsible dog owner than just ensuring your dog is registered and dissects. It would be great to see education campaigns around training animals, you know, around how to encourage recall so that you can trust them in public spaces. Even things like teaching, well, actually, some of the schools here do have this where they do dog safety classes and they teach children how to approach dogs and how to behave around unfamiliar animals, which I think is great, but I just think that needs to be a lot more widespread. I also think we do need more regulation of the dog training industry, because there are a lot of people out there who are portraying themselves as so-called dog behavior experts or experienced dog trainers, and some of them don't have any credentials. They haven't done, or they might have done a very basic course, but there's no regulation of the courses. So how can you know that that's the best training available and that they are teaching your dog using the most current methods? You know, I had that issue with my own dog, Tex. He's my old boy. He's nearly 13 now. But when he was 6, he started displaying what we now know were the signs of an anxiety disorder. He started to kind of display random aggression towards other dogs, and he would try to kind of attack bikes and skateboards and things like that. And so we enlisted one of these quote-unquote canine behavior experts who gave us a few tips and whatnot, and nothing really worked, and in fact his behavior worsened. And we finally consulted an actual veterinary behaviorist. She's a vet, but she also has additional qualifications in animal behavior from an actual brain perspective. You know, she's looked at the actual physiology of a dog's brain and how it's built and how it operates. And she told us that everything this behavior expert had told us was wrong. And it was outdated. And, you know, veterinary knowledge doubles every year. So these people need to be compelled to keep up to date and not peddle these old, outmoded training methods. So that's a very long-winded answer, but the short version is I think there is a lot more we can do, and it starts with education and regulation.
I have a friend who has a little dog. He's a cross between a Pomeranian and something else. I can't quite think of it off the top of my head. He's 11, and he's suddenly developed a fear, an anxiety situation when he gets into a car and he's going somewhere. Mm. He'll start shaking. So obviously he needs a little bit of attention.
Yeah, he could be. And I mean, what I would say, first of all, is take him to the vet to make sure there is no physical cause, that he's not in pain, that something about the way he sits or where he is secured in the car isn't physically hurting him, or he doesn't have some, you know, I don't know, an ear infection that's causing motion sickness or something like that. Always try to rule out any physical cause of anxiety or aggression first. But if that doesn't work, then by all means, I would recommend that she consults an actual veterinary behaviorist. As happened with my dog, Tex, he was diagnosed with a generalized anxiety disorder and put on doggy Prozac. And people always laugh when I say that. But in fact, it's not doggy Prozac. It's actual Prozac. It's the exact same medication that humans take. It induces a lot of eye rolling in people who think, oh my goodness, you know, what are we doing to our dogs now that they need to be on Prozac? But I think it's a wonderful thing that we now have this tool that is available to treat our best friends when they develop these issues, because in years gone by, that wasn't available to us. And dogs that were deemed aggressive or highly strung or whatever faced a much, much worse fate than just taking a tablet every day for the rest of their lives. So I say anyone who would sneer at the idea of medical intervention for canine anxiety should probably have a look at where those feelings are coming from and don't rule it out, because it can be enormously helpful. In Tex's case, it basically gave him his life back. He became a puppy again. And it was only after he got well that I could see how unwell he had been. So I thank Prozac very much for saving my dog.
My friend will certainly be listening to your interview.
Oh, good.
Now, the role of dogs in our lives has changed so drastically from those early days of purely being farm dogs. Mm. In your book, you mention if the Employee of the Month awards were open to all species, working dogs would win every single time. And working dogs have evolved to include carer dogs, special needs dogs, all sorts of things. Do you want to expand on that statement?
Yes, absolutely. Well, when I came up with the idea of writing Dogs with Jobs, I wanted to write a book that really highlighted just how capable dogs are and how many different jobs they can do. Because I think when you hear working dog, most of us still immediately tend to think of either the farm dog, you know, that the cattle dog that's out there rounding up the cows or running across the backs of the sheep, or we think of military dogs, sniffer dogs, that kind of thing. But in fact, the jobs that dogs are capable of doing are just, I mean, there is really no end to what we can train a dog to do. They're so capable, they're so intelligent, very handily, they're enormous people pleasers, so they want to make us happy, and they like to work. That's the key thing about dogs. They like to have a job to do. And anyone who's ever experienced a dog that likes to dig or chew or just generally make a nuisance of themselves can probably attest to that fact. If a dog doesn't have a job, it will find one. He will make one up for himself, and it's usually not going to be one that we want him to do. So I think even for a pet dog, they need to have a job to do to an extent, because they have such quick minds. And they need to be engaged and they need to be enriched. So that was really what I wanted to highlight with this book, is just the vast array of things that dogs can and will do for us.
Mm. And often they're jobs that no one else can do.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, dogs have the advantage of being a certain size and having equipment that humans don't have. So you can send tiny dogs into narrow spaces to sniff out earthquake survivors and somewhere that a person could never get. Or dogs have incredible noses, as we know, and that's because the olfactory bulb, the part of their brain that processes scent, is like 40 times bigger than a human's. So they can smell things that we would never ever have a hope of smelling. So yes, there are things that only they can do, or only they can do as well as they can do. I mean, humans could probably make an attempt at these things, but we would just never get the kind of results that dogs can get.
Well, when you think of a warship in a safe harbour, you write, the bog-standard, chip-stealing, squawking Aussie seagull is a hostile combatant for that warship. What happens there, and how can dogs help?
Yes, that's very true. And, it was funny when I was writing that chapter, actually, because I was thinking of all the things that, you know, could be dangerous to a warship. And, you know, of course, it's heavy seas and bad weather and enemy fire and all this kind of thing. The thing you don't think of is bird poo. But in fact, bird poo is incredibly acidic. It eats away at the paint and the varnish on warships. And if left untreated, it can cause rust. And you might think, oh, well, a bird dropping here and there isn't going to cause that much trouble for something the size of a warship, and that's probably true. But for historic vessels like the ones that are kept at the Australian Maritime Museum in Sydney, they're not going anywhere. And we're talking flocks of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of seagulls that are pooing on them all day, every day. So in fact, it was causing a lot of trouble for the shipkeepers to actually keep the ships clean, prevent that rust and damage, and just generally kind of preserve the integrity of the ship. So they tried everything to keep these birds away. They tried blasting sirens and loud music. They tried hanging reflective things like CDs to kind of scare them away. They installed fake birds of prey, thinking that might scare them off. And all of those things worked for a little while, but they weren't long-term solutions because the birds got used to them. Birds are pretty smart, and they soon figured out that those things weren't actually a threat because they were always there every day in the same place. So they got to know how to work around them, I suppose, and continue their merry pooing schedule. So eventually, what the Maritime Museum decided to do was get a dog. They had heard about a dog in the US who was employed, and I've written about him in my book as well, who was employed to chase wildlife away from a runway at an airport to keep the planes safe. So they thought maybe we could use a dog in a similar way at the museum to chase birds away from the boats. To say it worked would be a crashing understatement. I mean, they were going from having to high-pressure wash the ships and all the walkways in the museum every single day to, once they got the dog, twice a year. That's how effective he was. He is. He's still there. His name's Bailey. He's a rescue border collie. He's absolutely gorgeous. And if you go to the Maritime Museum, he does his walkabouts and you can ask to meet him, and he's very sweet. But yeah, I mean, they thought it would work, but even they were absolutely flabbergasted as to how well it worked and how quickly. So the amount of money they've saved in not having to constantly clean and repaint and repair these historic vessels is just immeasurable, all for a $300 dog adoption fee.
Oh, goodness. So they got him from the dog's home, did they?
They got him from Australian Working Dog Rescue, which I believe operates nationwide, but is New South Wales-based. I think they do adopt dogs interstate, though. But, yeah, they were looking for a dog that was already showing some aptitude for wanting to chase birds. And when they found Bailey, he was living with a foster carer up in Newcastle, and she was having to keep him inside almost all the time because he was proving such a terror with the birds on her property. He just would not stop chasing them. So as soon as they met him, they thought, yep, he's our boy. And the reason he's so effective is because he's not predictable. The birds don't know when he's going to be there. They know he's not static or fake, that he actually moves and he will actually come after them. So they've moved on. I think there is one kind of stubborn group of a particular seabird whose name escapes me right now that they're still having trouble with, but the seagulls have effectively gone, and it's all thanks to Bailey, and he just loves it. He absolutely loves his job, so he's absolutely perfect for it.
It's fabulous. And what's the name of the book that Bailey's in?
Bailey is in Dogs with Jobs. It's actually got a dog on the cover wearing a naval hat with a big warship in the background, although that's not Bailey. That's another very handsome dog.
Oh, fantastic. Laura, will you come back on to Service Voices in the coming months and talk more about dogs, those fabulous creatures who are, when they're working 24 hours a day, aren't they?
They really are, and all they ask in return is some food and, you know, for the highly trained sort of sniffer-type dogs, they like a bit of play with a ball or a rolled-up towel, somewhere warm to sleep and some belly rubs. I mean, how many of us would do our job for, for that kind of payment?
Exactly. We'd say, get lost.
That's right. I would.
Not the dogs, though.
That's right.
Laura, you have a story about a dog who virtually saved a Vietnam veteran's life. What was that all about?
Yes, so that was in my book, The Rescuers, which is all about dogs that were rescued themselves, whether from pounds or, you know, animal welfare groups, that then went on to rescue someone else, either physically, as in actually saving their life, or in a more kind of spiritual sense. So there is a story in The Rescuers about a Vietnam veteran who lives in Adelaide. He's called Peter Harron. Some people might be familiar with him. He was a Sunday Mail journalist for many, many years and is now quite an accomplished artist. But yes, he served in Vietnam, and he was on the tracking team. So all the people on that team had dogs that had been rescued from pounds and then trained up to track the enemy in Vietnam. He was not a bomb-sniffing dog. He wasn't trained to sniff out landmines or bombs or anything like that. But on this one occasion, Peter and his dog Caesar were tracking the Viet Cong through the jungle, and Caesar suddenly stopped. and would not allow Peter to take another step forward. And, you know, no matter what he did, he just couldn't encourage him on. Caesar actually sat on his foot as if to say, nope, we are staying here and that's it. And a short time later, another team came along and did proceed down that same track and unfortunately detonated a landmine. So Caesar had somehow, even though he wasn't trained for it, had somehow detected that landmine, prevented Peter and his team from walking straight into it. Really, really incredible. And Peter was so touched and impacted by that moment that he never forgot Caesar. He actually wrote a book called Trackers, all about Caesar and his experiences in Vietnam. None of the dogs were repatriated to Australia, so he never knew what had become of Caesar, although he'd heard that he was adopted to a British family in Vietnam. And anyway, years later, he was at a reunion of his company and someone came up to him. He never saw who it was, but put Caesar's dog tag on the table in front of him and then disappeared, which is really quite incredible. I mean, it gives me chills even now just thinking about it. But he donated Caesar's tag to the War Memorial in Canberra. So it's on permanent display there. You can go and see it. And Peter also became an integral part of memorialising Australian war dogs and having the memorial and the statue of Caesar established here in Sydney. So it's really another one of those stories of where an encounter with a dog actually goes on to sort of shape your life in a way. He was cognizant of the fact that Caesar had undoubtedly saved his life and he never forgot it, and it absolutely drove him to ensure that war dogs were remembered and are remembered forever.
And rightly so.
Absolutely.
What wonderful stories, and there must be thousands more, not only of dogs, but our other animals that have contributed to saving the lives of our troops.
That's right, definitely.
Laura, thank you very much for talking with Service Voices, and we really do look forward to that next interview.
Thank you so much for having me, and it would be my absolute pleasure to come back again.